Hello, my friends. I'm Shay Marville. Welcome to the second season of Let's Talk, a podcast dedicated to healing and growing through conversations, stories, and deep listening. We are an alchemy of one another. Talking helps us to relieve our burdens, to suffer less, because we are each other's medicine if we choose. So let's talk. Hello, my friends. In the pod today, we have Dr. James Hollis. He's a Washington, D.C.-based Jungian psychoanalyst and author of 17 books. I had a chance to catch up with him a few months ago. He taught humanities for 26 years in various colleges and universities before completely changing his life and becoming a Jungian analyst at the Jung Institute of Zurich in Switzerland in 1977. He's a licensed Jungian analyst in private practice in Washington, D.C. He served as executive director of the Jung Educational Center in Houston. Then he was the executive director of the Jung Society of Washington. He serves on their board. He now speaks around the world about how to find meaning in our lives and in our dreams. Dr. James Hollis, I just want to welcome you to Let's Talk. And to my audience across North America and the world, I was so excited and curious to speak to you about your perspective and interpretation of what we are going through right now in the pandemic from a Jungian point of view. I've talked to so many listeners and my own clients who are struggling right now to find meaning in what's happening. And so part of why I reached out to you was that I thought, you know, I just wanted to know how you were approaching this moment that we are in.
Certainly. Well, first of all, it's a pleasure to be with you. And
thank you.
I think this is the first time since World War II where everyone at some level was directly affected. Mm-hmm. Meaning, you know, we have disasters from time to time, vast social and political experiences, but it's often out there. It's not something that comes into my home or threatens me personally or my family in a way in which a virus can. Mm-hmm. So in a certain way, it's been experienced in a personal way as opposed to simply just happening somewhere.
Yes.
Secondly, I think for all of us to some degree and for some folks, in large measure, it reveals the degree to which we have been dependent upon those outer structures, such as going to work, seeing friends and family, hanging out in certain places, travel, a thousand different things out there that have been part of the richness of life. But also when they're not available or they're challenged in some way, what does it do? It throws us back upon ourselves in some way. Mm-hmm. Now, a lot of folks have adjusted very well, and some other folks have adjusted rather poorly, as a matter of fact. And I think for everyone, it raises the question of what dependencies we might have. Mm-hmm. What am I dependent upon to be carrying my sense of self or yes. give me marching orders? Now, this shows up in many places in one's life. You know, the empty nest syndrome is, well,
yeah.
I was plugged into being this parent and now they're gone. Who am I? Or losing a job, you know,
yes.
you know, or
losing your identity.
You know, a number of folks when they hit retirement feel completely disoriented and don't know quite what to do with their own lives and so forth. So Jung said something once that's very profound, and I think about it literally every day. He said, we all need to know what supports us when nothing supports us.
Wow.
So what that means is whatever my outer structures may be, my partnership, my children, my family, mm-hmm. my work assignments, my professional identity, whatever it may be, if that's threatened, if that's taken away in any way, then who am I, you see? And what is it that supports me from within? What carries me through those difficult times? And I think that's something that's hit all humans on this planet to some degree, and for some in very large degree.
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think this is such a transformative time economically, you know, socially, you know, globally. And it's the first time we're all going through to a certain degree the same event. We're all aware of it. But there's also another piece to this around our belief system and this idea about what makes us happy, what makes us well, and what it takes to do that. And it feels as though there are many people, no matter what their economic situation is, that are struggling psychically because they're not certain who they are or what is valuable to them.
Of course. No, that's absolutely the case. And of course, underneath all of that is this floating question of identity. Who am I apart from my roles?
Yes.
The roles may be wonderful roles or terrible, as the case may be, but who am I apart from those roles? Who am I apart from my outer relationships? Who am I apart from my structures out there? Because this can happen to any of us at any time in our life. We can have a crippling accident or a malignant disorder take over our lives. And we need to be able to see there's something within us that is buoyant, that is resilient, that in fact, as carriers of the human DNA, we all have something within us that leads to a certain resilience. I mean, how did this species survive on a very complex and difficult planet all these years? It survived through a certain resilience that is inherent in us, but we don't know what we're capable of until in some way we have to go through it. And then people find, you know, I do have the resources within to carry me through whatever these circumstances may be.
And is it understanding what is meaningful to you and what you truly care about that helps you to weather the storms? Is it that when you don't know what's meaningful that you feel more disconnected from surviving?
Sure. No, we happen to be the animal that's the meaning-seeking and meaning-creating animal. And more human distress comes out of disconnects from meaning than any other single cause of our suffering. And as Jung put it once again, he said, the smallest thing with meaning is often larger than the largest thing without meaning. So we can have all of the outer rewards and reinforcements.
Yes.
But it ceases to be meaningful over time. And therefore, we have to discern, well, what is it that my own psyche responds to?
Yes, that's a profound question.
Yeah. And the interesting thing is, and this is going to sound like psychology 101, but we have to go back and recover a relationship to our natural being. So nature has equipped us with elemental systems that help guide us. We knew it as children, but as children, we're tiny, vulnerable, dependent, and we have to start adapting to the world around us. And those adaptations are necessary and protective, but they also have a tendency to take us away from those guiding sources. So, for example, number one, we all have a feeling function. Well, we know that, but when you stop and think about feelings happen autonomously. You and I do not create them. Something in us responds. Then, of course, consciousness, the ego consciousness, can either, you know, pay attention to that or anesthetize that or repress it or be distracted from it or split it off or project it onto someone else. But if I realize that there is within me a qualitative, autonomous, qualitative analytic process going on about whether something is right or wrong for me, whether it's positive or negative, that's important for me to know. In other words, I might be in a career that is very rewarding, fiscally rewarding, gives the plaudits of others, et cetera. One's climbing the corporate ladder or whatever, but it's meaningless. You know, many people get to the top and realize there's nothing there, as
That's
we
right.
all know. So paying attention to that over time means, okay, that tells me something, because I don't choose those feelings. There's something there that I need to pay attention to. Secondly, our energy system. We can mobilize energy. And that's important. That's necessary. For that reason, we can get out of bed at 3 a.m. and feed the baby who's hungry or get to work and pay our bills. But if over time you keep mobilizing your energies in places that are not right for you, it always leads to boredom, burnout, self-medication, and so forth. And yet we've had those moments when you're in right relationship to your own soul, and I'm using that word soul, and there's the literal translation of psyche, our own psyche, it's our own deep reality. When you're in contact with that, you have plenty of energy. It supports you. Mm-hmm. And we've all had that experience of being in what they call the flow, you know, where there's something that just carries you, because you're in harmony then with your own psychological reality. Thirdly, we have dreams. And since I operate from a psychodynamic standpoint, we pay attention to the fact that some autonomous other in me creates, on an average, as sleep research has told us, 6 dreams per night. And of course, everyone's going to say, well, I don't dream or I don't remember my dream.
That's beside
the point. The activity is still going on. We can prove that with brainwave studies. So the psyche is seeking to formulate a response to our lives. Before talking to you just now, I spent 3 hours earlier this morning doing, among other things, working with people's dreams. Which have come to them and gives them a deep sense of some internal understanding or some internal authority, if you will, that is commenting on their lives.
I was going to ask you about that. Mm-hmm. You know, people are always trying to understand, you know, what's the value of their dreams? And is it literal? Is it a story? Is it an interpretation? How do you explain what a dream is and the value of it to your awoke self?
Yeah, sure. Well, first of all, as I mentioned, we dream every night and nature doesn't waste activity. So it serves a purpose, even if we don't pay attention. And part of that purpose may be to work through, burn out the magnitude of stimuli we get in any given day. Because our body forces us to spend up to a third of our entire life in the dream state or in the resting state, the sleeping state. And part of that is dreams, of course. If you live to 80, and I'm 81, if you live to 80, 6 years of your entire life will be spent dreaming. Think of that. Is nature going to waste its effort? I doubt it.
No. Right? 6 years. Wow.
Yeah, that's amazing. I'm amazed by the figure too, but it's accurate. And secondly, if we pay attention, we realize our psyche is commenting on our lives. And there are different kinds of dreams. There are reactive or processing dreams. You'll say you have conflict at work and you don't pay attention to it, but maybe it'll show up in the dream. Or you're worried about something, but you've brushed it aside and it'll manifest in a way. So it's sort of processing your daily life. That's useful. And too often people would stop and say, oh, I know what that dream's about. I saw it on television last night, or I read that in the paper, or somebody said something. Well, the dream is not obliged to comment on what you did yesterday. If it's choosing to focus on that, don't take that literally. Maybe it's about that issue, and maybe it's just using that issue to talk about, well, here's another occasion where you've had an old inferiority complex activated, or here's another time. We're conflict avoidant, and you may not see the connection. In other words, I could have avoided standing up for something that was important, let's say it in a place of employment.
Yes.
And dream later about grade school, and you think, well, it has nothing to do with it. How ridiculous dreams are, and I don't have to pay attention. But then you go back and you look at it and you ask, why did my psyche pull that image out of my history? And at that moment, you begin to rise. Well, that's where I learned it was dangerous to express my opinion. That's where I learned that hiding out or avoiding was a better path. But of course, there's a price for that. We also have dreams that are compensatory. Mm-hmm. As our conscious life pushes us in this direction, we get unbalanced and we get disconnected from our own center. So it's trying to reassert a balance in our lives. Very rarely, there are dreams which are prophetic in nature. They happen, they've been reported throughout history, where something in the human psyche is trolling the energies and issues going on in our time and place and forming certain impressions there. It's rare, but it happens. And also there are archetypal dreams, which are dreams that in effect belong to the tribe, to the human species, rather than just the individual. But the most common dreams are the processing dreams and the compensatory dreams. And those are the ones that most of us remember most of the time.
Is it our soul? Is it our soul that's speaking to us during our dreams? Could you say that? Or is it
Yes. And when we use the word soul, for some people, that may conjure up some sort of dogmatic associations or whatever. I'm just trying to use it as a literal translation of the word psyche. And by the way, psychotherapy, from the Greek word therapoi, that means to listen or attend to the soul. See, now that already puts a different frame of reference, doesn't it?
Completely, because we're also so, in our material society, we focus so much on what you can buy and you can see. Mental health, emotional well-being, these things are seen as lesser faculties at times, even though we do a lot of talking about them. And that's why I feel like during this pandemic, people are having soul and spiritual crises, and they don't actually even have the language or the discernment to explore it, to know how to explore it.
That's right. Know? No, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. Yeah, and by the way, the word psychopathology, if we translate the pieces from the Greek, means the expression of the suffering of the soul.
Mm.
So rather than say, how quickly do I rid myself of this symptom, we would rather ask the question, why has it come?
Oh, that's profound.
What is it asking of me? This is a whole different orientation.
Oh, I that's so profound.
Well, let me give a personal example. At midlife, by the time I was 30, I had achieved everything that I thought it was important in my life to achieve, and it was all good. Mm-hmm. No complaints. And from about 31, 32 onwards, I fell into this depression. And it sent me for the first time into therapy. I didn't think of that as sort of starting the second half of my life journey. But it ultimately led me to a whole new different profession. I retrained and so forth. I left academia for clinical practice and so
forth. That's when you studied in Zurich.
That's correct. Yes, yes. And when I went there, I didn't plan to change careers. I was assuming that this is just a way of taking this process deeper and deeper. And indeed it was. But I found that I was appreciating that kind of conversation, which was, generally speaking, not available in academia, even though I valued teaching and continue to teach up to this moment.
Yes.
So, you know, my first thought would be, like anyone else, how do I get rid of a depression? When the real question is, why has your psyche autonomously, and there's that word again, autonomous, because, you know, we're not running the show here. The ego thinks it is, but something else is running the show. I mean, what's growing your toenails as we talk? What's digesting your food?
Yes.
What's creating your thought and emotional? I mean, that's something outside the sphere of ego consciousness, all right?
Mm-hmm.
And then I had to ask the question, why has your psyche autonomously withdrawn its approval and support from where you've put all of your investment? It's not saying they're wrong. It's saying you need to see them from a different frame of reference. And that was the beginning of a humbling process of self-discovery.
Yeah.
And ultimately, this work is always humbling because we're always being asked to confront something we didn't know was at work.
Yeah.
When you make a decision, for example, who are the other players at the table making votes? Because the ego's not a CEO that it thinks it is. There are many corporate partners, invisible partners, if you will, at the corporate board table, psychologically speaking.
Yes.
And that's why I said, when I make a decision and execute a behavior, whether it's good or bad is really based on what is that really in service to inside of you.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, you may not know. But that's the beginning of an important investigation. If I do a good thing, is that a good thing or is it an old codependent thing?
Right. And is it something you've learned? Is something you've already you've learned as an adaptation process, and you keep doing it? Like, is that why sometimes we unconsciously repeat behavior that we know does not serve us?
That's right.
But we keep doing it.
That's right. I had a client who was a long-term member of AA in Houston many years ago, and he said, one of the sayings of his group was, "This isn't working for me, but I do it very well." And I thought, that's a marvelous sentence, because that could apply to all of our lives. Mm-hmm. This doesn't work for me, but I've gotten very used to doing it. You know, I'm an expert.
Yes. Yes.
Avoidance or accommodation or something like that.
Yes, yes.
That was once protective, but today binds me to that disabled past, you see.
When you decided to, well, you sort of evolved into a new life in your late 30s and created a new career as a Jungian and analyst, did you feel like there's something physically happened to you where you became like emotionally one person? You no longer were you in different parts, but you found yourself coming completely together and knew who you were at that point?
It's a very good question. I wouldn't put it that way. I think that we, in the course of any given day, we get pulled at from so many different directions, as you know. Mm-hmm. I often have the image of something unraveling, you know.
Yes.
And it's interesting enough, because Shakespeare, in one of his plays, talks about sleep that knits up the raveled brow of care. And I thought, it's interesting that Shakespeare occurred the same image of raveled and unraveled.
You know?
Sleep is about restoration, where you come back to yourself.
Yes.
So I would say that keeping our center is very, very difficult, particularly in times when we're bombarded by the stimuli coming in at us 24/7 around the clock. Mm. Of course, the irony is that's one of the great temptations or seductions of the modern world, is it is so distracting.
Mm-hmm.
The more I'm distracted, the less I have to reflect on these matters.
Yes, that's
and
right.
And then you say, all right, well, what's your life about? It's a series of conditioned respondings, you see. Can you really say it's your life? Mm. When your patterns emerge, where are they coming from in you? Hmm. The way I've often put it is, we don't wake in the morning, look in the mirror while brushing our teeth and saying, today you're going to do the same stupid things you've done for decades, you know?
No, you don't. Do that.
But there's the pattern. Yes. And then you realize, oh, where did that come from? Of course, many people never bother to stop and look at the patterns until the cost has gotten too heavy.
Yes, that's right.
And then you say, well, there are certain autonomous energies within me, what you might call complexes, that have a certain life of their own. And when they're triggered, when they're activated, they enact, they occupy my ego consciousness and execute their old performance, mm-hmm. you know, their old script. Jung called complexes splinter personalities. We have many splinter personalities. You know, there's the compliant child, the frightened person. There's the accommodating person. There's the person that prefers to stay on the sideline. There's the person that says, why don't you pay attention to me? I mean, which one is showing up in any given moment is not a question we ask of ourselves, but it's a useful question. What part of me made that decision? Where did that come from in me?
When should we start teaching young people, children, about how to perceive the world in this manner? It seems to me that, you know, I work with a lot of young people now, and a lot of young people, I'm just saying anecdotally, but I think the data is very clear that there are a lot of young people struggling right now. And that was prior to the pandemic. Because of social media and not fully being within their, knowing their own selves and being comfortable with their selves. Where do we enter a conversation with human beings between the age of 12 and 25?
Mm-hmm.
about these types of questions?
It's another great question. I think in some way the questions you and I were just talking about come later when they have had a chance to enter the world and build enough ego strength to bear that kind of self-examination. You know, I can think about when I was 18 or 21 and 22, when I'm leaving college and so forth and making major decisions. I had to operate under the assumption I knew what I was doing, even if I didn't at times. What happens later is what matters. The first half of life at some level can be a big mistake and perhaps an unavoidable mistake because you don't know what you're running from or what you're under what influence and so forth. I think the biggest issue for young people is a feeling of inherent self-worth. I'm not talking about any kind of narcissism. Narcissism is actually the opposite of that. Mm. A narcissist is a person who looks in the mirror and no one stares back. So they're always trying to control their environment, people in their environment or their situation to reflect favorably upon them. That's in fact a confession of insecurity, quite the contrary than the arrogance that it masks it. I think history would change if every child had said to it repeatedly with sincerity, who you are is terrific. Hmm. You are who you're supposed to be. Always be mindful of the impact of your choices upon other people. We're not trying to breed narcissistic people here, but be mindful of the impact of your choices on others, but you're here to live your journey. I was in a podcast a few months ago, and a person concluded by a question they always asked, and that was, if you could go back in history and talk to somebody, who would it be? And my first impulse, because I grew up in Springfield, Illinois, the home of Lincoln, was talk to Lincoln. But as I thought about it, I said, you know, I would go back and talk to myself as a 10-year-old. And I would say to that 10-year-old, it's okay. It's all right to be afraid. It's all right to not know what you're doing or where you're going. You're going to find your life is an interesting journey. You're going to find it rich with opportunities and rewards and struggles and heartaches. But you have something within you that will carry you through. And who you are is valuable and rich. And you're here to live that journey. Now, if I'm your parent or counselor or whatever, we'll always have an opinion, but your job is not to, you know, dominate. Match my opinions. That's up to me. If you want to hear what I think about something, just ask. But you're here to find your own path. Because why do we have to spend so much time? And this is also a cultural cliche about lying on a couch and complaining about mother and father. It's like, why do we have to spend so much time giving people permission to be who they are, to help untangle them from the world of expectations with which they grew up. And sometimes they were positive environments, sometimes they were quite negative in character. But the key, I would say, for any person under 30 is a feeling of permission to have your journey. Mm. Otherwise, you're going to be following what you're supposed to do or running from it or out there trying to escape it in some way. And none of that's going to work for you because it's not about you then.
No, it's not your fight, is it? It's someone else's expectations and values, right? I wonder about how you explain the value of finding meaning in your own life and not comparing that meaning to anyone else. Mm-hmm. Your meaning is your meaning. How do you find the ego strength as a young person or not even actually like as a middle-aged person? Because there's so many, you know, so many of us and so many middle-aged people who, you know, and you just talked about it, who go through that dark night of, you know, mm-hmm. who am I and what is this all for?
Mm-hmm. No, that's correct. Well, as I mentioned, we have those autonomous systems like the feeling function and the energy systems. And meaning is something that we don't find. It's something we experience. If meaning were an object, we could say, well, it's hiding somewhere in Saskatchewan. We could go there and look for it. You know, we just find it. We'll be happy, whatever that means. Meaning is a felt experience of being in right relationship to yourself. And by the way, meaning is not free of conflict and suffering. Most of the people you would admire most in history are people who had very difficult lives, lives often of great suffering and sacrifice. But what we admire about them is they found their path, they served their truth with fidelity and lived it through. And that's what we admire. You know, why are we here? Well, no one knows, but one of the ways you can look at it is here, I'm here to help embody whatever nature or divinity, whichever metaphor you prefer, is wanting to express through me in the world. It's not about me. You know, of course, when you're young, it's all about you. But yes, later on, you realize that's too small an investment. It's not about you. It's about what is worthy of your service. What is worthy of your life's energy? When I was a child, of course, I had the usual child's fantasies about being a major sports athlete, that kind of thing. And I never thought that I would spend my life hour after hour, day by day, listening to people's problems. I couldn't imagine. I don't say that I find that makes me happy. What I find is it's profoundly meaningful to be part of people's journey and to together confront the common issues of our journey as humanity. And having a work that is that meaningful makes me happy. You see, it's not the outer part of it, it's what it touches inside.
Yes. Happiness. What it stimulates inside of you that also gives you the capacity to be present with other people's suffering as well.
That's right. In other words, we don't choose meaning. Meaning is, again, autonomous within it.
Yes. In us.
We have to choose whether to take the risk necessary for that to be experienced in our lives.
Yes. Oh, that's so beautiful. And it's so true, because I know personally, there's so many things that are meaningful to me and they don't make sense to anyone else and they are not material, but being with people on their journey is something that I take a great pride in. And it's, you know, and I find that I have energy for it in a way that I don't have energy for doing my taxes.
That's right. Well, you don't enjoy doing taxes. It's stunning, stunning. Yes.
You're on your 18th book now, right?
Yes,
Prism.
In about 2 weeks ago, so it'll come out in 22. Yeah.
And what drives you to write such deeply profound books? I mean, sometimes I could just linger on a page of one of your books, and they're not big books, but they're so incredibly profound. How do you have the energy and the drive to keep writing and to have this many, you know, books?
Well, I'm going to sound a little mystical to you at this point, but the truth is, I don't know. In the ancient Greek world, they talked about the daimon, D-A-I-M-O-N, not to be confused with demon.
Yes.
The daimon was an intermediary spirit between humans and the gods. You know, Plato said, when I speak, it's the daimon who speaks through me, you see.
Mm-hmm.
So all of my writing comes at the end of a long workday. Mm-hmm. I don't have free days or rarely to write. And it's not like I sit down and think, well, I'm just going to chain myself for the next few months to the computer. It's something in me that is wishing expression.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what that is. I call it the daimon, just to borrow that ancient picture, because it's not my ego that's doing it, I can assure you.
No.
They're not meant to make money, and they don't make a lot of money, but they are, in fact, teaching instruments. I think
yes,
scattered classrooms around the world. That's a good thing, because I happen to think of myself as a teacher, but it's more importantly, it's something that wants expression through me. Mm-hmm. Because one of the ways of looking at life is, in the first part of life, is what does the world want of me, and can I meet those expectations and demands? But then the second half of life is what is wanting to enter the world through me.
Oh, could you say that? Could you repeat that question?
Sure, sure. The first half of life is about what do my parents want, the school teacher, the employer, the partner, the society, what do they want from me? And I have to mobilize enough ego strength to be able to interact with that, create yes. a life of some kind. Second half of life, if you're privileged to live a second half, mm-hmm. you have to ask, what is wanting to enter the world through me? You see? Mm-hmm. Then it's not about the ego. It's about submitting the ego to that. That's why I would say this work, which is very humbling and you know, fatiguing in many ways, mm-hmm. whether it's writing or therapy, is nonetheless experienced meaningful. So that's a decision made outside my ego state. And mm-hmm. I choose to submit to that because I find it profoundly meaningful. Mm-hmm. Something comes through me. I don't read my own stuff, but I sometimes have gone back to look up a quote or something. It's almost like someone else has written it.
Oh.
And that's peculiar to me because it's, again, something came through.
Something came
through. Familiar, but someone else's, so to speak.
And it's in service of something greater than you.
That's right. That's right. And to put it in a very explicit way, if I feel some of these insights of deaf psychology have been helpful to me and my clients, why would I not want to share that with others?
See, that's, absolutely.
I think there's a moral duty to do that.
Yes, know? Yes. I wonder about your commitment now to writing about or rewriting about archetypes. And I think it's the wounded healer that I'm also really interested in. Did uh-huh. I say that correctly?
It's the yes. wound.
Because I think we often don't talk about this, what people who are serving and in healthcare and in the professions of service, what it requires, and also, you know, the kind of sacrifice, but also why some people are there. It's almost like they're driven to be there by meaning, but then other people are driven because they are wounded and that's all they've ever known.
That's right. Well, yes, the idea of the wounded healer goes back thousands of years, and virtually every culture recognized at some point that the work is costly. I mean, many of us, and quite rightly, have been alerted to the tremendous emotional pressures on the healthcare profession, nurses and doctors, and some of them have been destroyed by that pressure, and they're all suffering from it for sure. So, you know, they're not automatons. They don't take you to nursing school or medical school and make you a machine. You carry all of that with you.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done research, as others have, in the area of the wounded healer. And the great preponderance of people in the helping professions came often from troubled childhoods where there were discords in the family and so forth. Not all of them, but by far the great percentage. Mm-hmm. So often the child there begins to perceive things are distressed here. I don't know what to do about it. And I'm going to have to make some adaptations and adjustments. And one child will be the A student, another will be the scout, another will act out in some way the stresses of the family, and so on and so on. And often children get pulled into trying to find some homeostasis between, you know, warring partners out here and that sort of thing.
Yes.
But whatever it is, the child's responding to the system, not to its own inherent developmental agenda. So it takes us away from ourselves. And for many of us, it makes us unconsciously identify with that role in later life. Mm. So studies have indicated that at some level, many in the helping professions, this includes not only medicine and therapy, but social work and clergy and so forth.
Yes.
And maybe even school teaching in some areas, that you feel bound to caring for others, because that was so critical in your history.
Yes.
But again, yes. It takes you away from your true calling in life, which might be to be a tree surgeon, a long-distance truck driver.
Yeah.
Country and Western singer. Who knows what your real calling would be? And I would go so far as to say, and this is just a metaphor here, 50% of people in the caregiving profession should not be there. They're there because of these internal complexes and assignments. Another 50%, that's their calling. you see.
Do you think that's why they pay such a high price? It, you know, because there's so much burnout in healthcare, and if you're not clear about the value of what you're doing to yourself,
that's right.
It can be so harmful. Yeah.
And this is seldom addressed in the training programs of caregivers. That's the point.
Mm.
You see, that's a betrayal of their souls, unwittingly. It's a betrayal of their souls that you're not paying much attention to what is bringing you to this work. You know, what's bringing you to this work? And at first, they may have some sort of noble, you know, rationalization for that. But over time, you really need to be asking that question. And sometimes I've seen people in the caregiving professions walk off and go in a different direction, and it saves their lives.
Yes.
Now, in the psychoanalytic traditions, we are obliged to be in our own analysis during that entire training process for several years.
Yeah, it's very intense. Is it five years?
Doesn't guarantee anything, but it's a good faith effort to sort out who are you in mm-hmm. relationship to this work.
Mm-hmm.
And that question not addressed in other, you know, academic training programs, whether it's psychology, psychiatry, whatever, often victimizes people unwittingly.
Mm.
So there is high burnout, enormous high burnout.
Incredible. I wonder about how you want to, like, what your next series will be about, you know, and your teaching. Are you moving in a new direction, or have all the last books informed where you're going for 2022 with your new book?
Well, it's both of those, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. The next book is called The Broken Mirror, and it's about the difficult self-knowledge and, how do we get a greater sense of ourselves and so forth? And
how do we get a greater sense of ourselves?
Yeah. And one that's not seen through distorted lenses when the mirror is broken, so to speak. You know.
Well, how do we? Like, how do you start to even consider that?
Well, first of all, that's complex. And I'm not avoiding your question.
I've got
several chapters addressing that. And one of the chapters is on how it's not what happens to me or to any of us. It's how we story it. Because we have, as infants and as children, as adolescents and adults, we're always needing to try to make sense of what happened. And of course, the need to know what happened and what it means, like who are you, who am I, and what's this all about, is also based on the limited perspective, let's say, of the child. Mm. And later, that becomes an operative narrative in a person's life. And you see those things playing out decades later. So part of what we have to do is examine what kinds of stories, and I put stories in quotes.
Yes,
you may not be conscious of them, but definitions of self and world and marching orders are playing out in my history and are derivative rather than central to who I am. That's part of the process. And of course, one of the ways to start with that are the patterns. If you say, all right, especially the patterns which are counterproductive in my life, maybe hurtful to me or hurtful to others.
Yes.
Where is that coming from in me? It wasn't that I woke up in the morning and decided to do that, but here it is. It shows that it's operating, again, autonomously in the unconscious. And the problem with the unconscious is it's unconscious. So I can't know what it's doing, but I can begin to visualize it. Or we see dreams that bring issues to us that we wouldn't have paid attention to otherwise.
Mm.
So, you know, the whole thing here is to try to ferret out perspectives on what's happening inside of each of us. And when you do that, you begin to realize this is an immense project. It's not self-absorption.
Hmm.
It's actually the single best thing you can do to improve all of your relationships to the outer world. Because I'm going to be no more involved in my relationship to my wife or my children or my society than I'm in relationship to myself.
Yes.
Where I'm stuck, where I'm blocked. It shows up in all those outer venues. Don't think it doesn't.
Totally. So
the best thing I can do for the other is gain more insight into what's making me tick and maybe make some correctives along the way.
And is the story the same as telling the truth?
Well, the truth is transcendent to the story. In other words, if my story was the truth, then I would be what happened to me.
Mm.
And I'm not what happened to me.
Mm.
Why do we have psychopathology? In other words, I follow, and this is what happens to many people at midlife. They set out and they do their best. They follow the story their culture has for them or their family of origin has for
yes.
them. Or they concluded themselves. And then it blows up on them. The marriage falls apart. The career doesn't work out, whatever. And you're thrown back onto the drawing board, you see. Mm-hmm. So the question then is what, again, what is wanting expression through me? That's a different question.
Yes, very.
And that's when you begin to critique your own stories. Another thing that I learned in Zurich, and it was probably the most difficult thing of all to cope with, and that is what you've become is now your chief obstacle. In other words, what have we become? A series of defenses, mechanisms for functioning in the world, and so forth, perhaps wholly necessary. That's the important thing. We're saying this without judgment. Necessary. But they stand in the way of who you are, and they tie you to that past without your knowing. Okay? Now, I'll give you another specific example. I've always loved learning. I've always loved teaching. That's one reason I agreed to do a podcast, you see. But, you know, in the early part of my life, I think I overemphasized the life of the mind and the ivory tower, if you will, as a defense against the magnitude of roiling feelings inside, which the child perceived as overwhelming at the time. So
yes.
I learned to sort of distance myself from them, you see. And I think that's one reason why the psyche reached up at midlife and pulled me under and says, you know something? We're going to make sure you deal with this now. We're pulling you into this.
Yes.
And something I realized, that's why I wound up going all the way to Zurich, which is a crazy thing to do. But it was saying, all right, in for a penny, in for a pound. In other words, this is about saving your life. In some way. I mean, my life was fine, but we're talking about something else.
Yeah, a different kind of life, a deeper life force.
That's right.
Is what you're talking about. Yes.
That's right. And it had been mostly, and this was rich and valuable. I still treasure it, was the life of the mind, but not necessarily a life of the heart. You know, that's a different matter.
Mm.
That has to come later. And the child had the heart, but he also realized it was pretty costly in the world. So I learned to defend against that.
Do you think Jungian analysis bridges this gap, this artificial gap between the mind and the heart? Does it move us to this mindset where the mind and the heart and the body are all one, like in Eastern type of philosophy? Is it less Western in that way, do you think?
Well, I think it certainly seeks to do that, yes.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lifetime goal. It's not like it suddenly happens. Look, most psychology, as you know, falls into three categories. Behaviorism, cognitive psychology, and pharmacology.
Yes.
Now, we are bodies, so there are chemical processes in us. We are behaviors, and we can correct some of those. We are thought processes, which can be challenged and amended also. But you put all that together, and you still don't have the human being. That's why all of those things put together, and they're critical and important, still don't address the question of meaning. Is the life you're living meaningful? Not saying free of conflict, free of ambiguity and ambivalence at times. Maybe suffering, but is it an authentic journey for you? Something inside of you knows the difference. And if you don't connect with that, you'll pay for it. And so will your people around you.
Yes, yes,
yes. He said once something that properly should haunt every parent. He said the greatest burden a child must bear is the unlived life of the parent. It means by that where you were stuck, blocked, stymied, let's say by fear, lack of permission, whatever. Your children are going to get that. They'll absorb it, whether you know it or not. And they'll spend their life being stuck in the same way or trying to get unstuck from that. And when they're doing it, they're living an aspect of your unfinished business and not
yes.
yours, not theirs.
Yes. Wow. And I mean, and how many of us have done that for our parents?
Well, of course.
Right.
Well, and of course, who makes babies but young people who are yes. still trying to escape their own process, their own history. And, you know, if I'm ever appointed emperor of the universe, I'll say you can't date till you're 50. Don't dream of marriage till you're 75. And you have to be 100 to consider being a parent. and even then, there's no guarantee you'll get it right. You know,
there goes the species. Exactly. Or because we craft a new story, we live longer. Listen, I know that you have a very busy day ahead of you. I am incredibly grateful for your time. I'd love to have you back on the show. But I also want to just thank you because here we are, we're in different countries, different generations, different backgrounds, and your work has impacted me so profoundly. I have to tell you, I am so, so thankful to you. And so I just wanted you to be aware of that. So
thank you very much. Listen, I'm a teacher and that's what teachers do. So I appreciate that. And let's let the classroom continue. So
okay, we will. My friend, thank you so much. Thank you so much, Dr. Hollis. Good day. I'm Shay Marville, and you've been listening to Let's Talk, a podcast dedicated to healing and growing. You can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And listen, I need your help to grow the reach of this show. Could you, would you, please subscribe, rate, and review us on any platform that you're listening to. I'd love to hear your feedback. Ciao for now.